Tonight we're moving on to another Chinese person with a really unpronounceable name, which is spelt in... I've noticed two, actually, so far, spellings of Huining. Is there anyone who can speak Chinese here? No? Right, okay, so it doesn't matter. Whatever it is. What? Jin's not here, so I can just say it. Huining. He's known as the founding father of a particular school of Zen Buddhism and the sixth patriarch. So there were quite a number of sort of leaders of the Zen schools throughout history, and he's the sixth one. And Huineng is famous for something called the Platform Sutra, or the Sutra of Huineng. And this is quite interesting, actually, because it's the only... Buddhist teaching from a Chinese teacher that's actually been called a sutra. You might get the teaching of, how do you say Chi Yi now, correctly?
Chu Yi.
And you might get the teaching of, you know, whatever, and someone else who I can't pronounce. But you don't get them being called sutras. So it being called a sutra is like saying this is the word of the Buddha. Obviously, it's not the word of the Buddha. It's the word of Huineng. But it's saying this is really important. It's as if it were the word of the Buddha. It's considered so important that it's been called a sutra. And it's the only Chinese work to be called a sutra. So it just gives an indication of how important Huineng is, particularly in the Zen tradition of Buddhism. And interestingly, if you read this, not very big, this is the library's copy. If you read this, the first chapter of it, it's kind of collected teachings of Huineng, collected teachings and collected sayings. And if you read the first one, it's actually his autobiography. And I'm going to concentrate on that today. And it's interesting that it starts off with his autobiography that Huineng gave, where he was asked to give a teaching on the Dharma, and what he gave was his autobiography. And in a way, that signifies how important that he thought that story was. And I think it is important because it contains some truths and some teachings within itself. And that's what I want to concentrate on this evening. And the main teachings which I'm going to bring out is that basically he highlights the role of faith or Shraddha, and I know you've looked at that a bit last week. And he also highlights the role of direct experience in understanding the universal insights of the Dharma. So he's really highlighting faith and the direct understanding of the Dharma itself. So a bit about Huineng is he was born apparently in the year 638 in a very, very poor family. So his father died when he was young. And his mother, who was apparently in misery and sorrow, brought him up. They were very poor. He was illiterate. And they lived in Canton, which is in sort of southeast China, which apparently it seems to be known as a land of barbarians. I don't think they thought very highly of Canton in that time in China. And I was trying to think, well, what would be the equivalent of that in Britain? But then I thought, if I said that and someone was from that place, then I'd get into real trouble. So just it was just known as being really backward. And I'll leave it there. Land of barbarians. So anyway, the story goes like this. One day, when he was a lad, Huineng was selling firewood in Canton, and he heard a monk reciting the Diamond Sutra. And so this is the last stanza of the Diamond Sutra, so I'm going to read it to you. So let's see what happens to you when I read it. So really listen. Something might happen. So he says, it says, as stars, a fault of vision as a lump, a mock show, dewdrops or a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash or cloud, so should one view what is conditioned. As stars, a fault of vision as a lump, a mock show, dewdrops or a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash or cloud, so should one view what is conditioned. And it says that Huineng, as soon as he heard those verses, he says, as soon as I heard the text of this sutra, my mind at once became enlightened. I love the way they say these things. Oh, as soon as I heard that sutra, at once my mind became enlightened. Jolly good. On to the next thing. Tick that box. But it's really important that actually, that just that pure statement, as soon as I heard the text of this sutra, my mind at once became enlightened. And I know that Vedanya mentioned this last week, but I'm going to read out a bit, because the same thing happened to Sangharakshita, who founded this movement. And he puts it in a slightly more kind of explanatory and slightly more at length. But it's interesting, this whole experience. He says, if when I read Isis Unveiled, I knew that I was not a Christian, when I read the Diamond Sutra, so that's the same sutra that Huineng heard, I knew that I was a Buddhist. Though this book epitomizes a teaching of such rarefied sublimity that even arahants, saints who have attained individual nirvana, are said to have become confused and afraid when they hear it for the first time, I at once joyfully embraced it with an unqualified acceptance and assent. To me, the Diamond Sutra was not new. I had known it and believed it and realized it ages before, and the reading of the sutra, as it were, awoke me to the existence of something I had forgotten. Once I realized that I was a Buddhist, it seemed to me that I had always been one, that it was the most natural thing in the world to be, and that I had never been anything else. My experience of the Sutra of Huineng, which we're looking at this evening, though taking place at a slightly lower level, was repeated with much greater frequency. When I read the text, I would be thrown into a kind of ecstasy. So something happens, something goes on. They hear this text, Sangharakshita and Huineng, and they respond to it. And they respond to it with something that in Buddhism we call Shraddha, or faith. And what strikes me is that they respond to it with an absolute certainty. They don't just think, oh, that's a nice pretty verse, you know, that, or even, oh no, I kind of get what that's talking about. They actually see the thing itself that the text is trying to communicate. They experience the experience that the text is talking about. It's a bit like those texts. They're trying to point at an experience that can't really be put into words. And it's sometimes described like a finger pointing to the moon. They're trying to explain something that's actually a bit beyond our understanding, a bit beyond our limits of reason. They're trying to describe an experience. And some people, on hearing that description, actually understand the experience itself. And from that moment on, their life completely changes it. They don't just hear it and think, oh yeah, that's nice. They live it. They breathe it. They understand it to the depths of their being. And it transforms their whole life. And, you know, they don't need to be sort of say, well, that's an interesting text. When was that written? What historical context was that written in? And in what time and place? Or they don't ask for an explanation. They don't ask for a context. They don't answer, yeah, well, that's interesting, but, you know, they actually really understand it and live by it. And I think those two examples, Sangharakshita and Huineng, give an example of this ideal of Buddhist Shraddha, which I'm going to talk about in a bit more depth. So Shraddha, as I've said, is the Sanskrit, Moggaksha Siddhartha Sanskrit, yes, right, good. Sanskrit word for faith. But what we usually think with faith is, well, first of all, people will get irritated, then they get bored, and they have this idea that faith is about putting your brain on hold, you know, some sort of opiate for the people, something for slightly people of sort of maybe lesser intelligence or something. Anyway, we've got this whole package of ideas what faith might mean. And in a way, what I'd like you to do is just mentally pick that up and just throw it out the window. Because it's got nothing to do with what Buddhist faith means. Buddhist faith is actually, it's Shraddha. I think it's better to use the word Shraddha than faith, actually. Because it's quite specific in its usage. And it's said that Shraddha has three aspects to it. And I'll just go through each one and just tell you a bit about Huineng and how he manifested this. So the first aspect of faith is confident faith. It's a deep conviction of what is real. So it's a bit like you understand something with your intellect, you understand it with your reason. But it's a bit more than that. You actually understand it to the core of your being. You understand it with your guts. It's that kind of feeling when you hear something and you say, yes. Yes, I understand that. Yes, that rings true with me. It's a bit like all the pieces fit into place. You know your life. You've all lived a life. You've all seen things. You've all heard things. You've all made conclusions about things. You've all pondered on life and... thought about things. And sometimes you hear something and it just seems to bring those things together and you think, oh yeah, I get that. I really get that. And in a way, you know it to the depths of your being and you're also prepared to live by it. So it's called a deep conviction of what is real. So we're not talking about leaps of faith, prompted by a wish that it were true. Well, I wish that there was someone in the sky who was going to look out for me, so I'm just going to believe it. It's actually founded on a certainty backed up by reason, but going beyond just reason. It's not just about an intellectual understanding. It's something more than that. It's a real conviction, an emotionally held conviction as well. So it's your reason and your emotion. And it's not about going along with something which is completely illogical or irrational. It's not saying you should, going beyond the intellect doesn't mean believing in something that doesn't make sense. If something doesn't make sense, you're not going to believe it. If you know something to be illogically inconsistent, you're not going to believe it. You're not going to be able to have a conviction that it's true because it's logically inconsistent. And in a way, what I've just said, some of you might be thinking, yeah, but if you actually read the Diamond Sutra, and if you actually read the Sutra of Hui Ning, there's some pretty weird stuff in there. And sometimes the Dharma can sound a bit logically inconsistent or illogical. But actually, I don't think it is. It's not saying something that's logically inconsistent. It's trying to describe an experience that's beyond reason. And sometimes Buddhist teachings take reason to its limits. The Diamond Sutra takes reason right to its limit. So Sangharakshita calls it, rational irrationality or something. What he's saying is there's a difference between something being completely weird and logically inconsistent and you can't believe it. But there's a difference between that and actually being using paradox and some kind of sort of strange logic to take you to the end of your reason. So that's a bit about what the Diamond Sutra was like. It's a bit like you read it, and as Sangharakshita said, it's a bit threatening. Sometimes the Dharma is a bit threatening, actually. It undermines some of your story about the world, which you kind of would like to hold on to. But at the same time, when he heard that, he knew that it was true. He knew that it was real. He had a deep conviction in its reality. So, and what it did is they understood it as true, but it also took them into the experience that it was describing itself. So that's what happened to Hui Ning and Sangharakshita. They heard it and they knew it was true. They really saw all the pieces fit together and they said, yes, I understand that. I've seen that. I understand that. And another aspect of faith is called lucid faith. So sometimes it's called lucid faith. Sometimes it's called admiring faith. And in a way, when you've got that conviction, when you've got that real understanding, oh yes, I understand that to be true, you have to put it into practice, into your life. Your emotions immediately come behind you. You can't have that kind of understanding and go, yeah, that's really, really true, but I'm just going to ignore it. Actually, what happens is you become fired up by it. So it's a bit like, sometimes you have an idea and it's really good and you can really feel that idea and you really know it's the right thing to do. And even if it's difficult, you get the strength, you get the fired upness. You get the clarity to know what you need to do to put that into practice. And it's interesting because you sometimes see this at the Buddhist Centre, and it's particularly if someone asks for ordination or they ask to become a Mitra, something happens to their face. And it's a bit like what happens to their face is clarity and a deep contentment. And even if it's difficult for them to ask, and you know, people are embarrassed when they ask to become a mitra or they ask for ordination. And they, you know, they're going to remember something, they're going to say something to you. But it's like there's something in their face which is really pure and it's really clean. And it's like they know exactly what they need to do. And it frees them up. And I think that's the expression. It's really beautiful, actually, because they're freed up. They know what they have to do. And all the crap and all the... Sorry, I'm not allowed to say I'm dumb. All the superficialities and petty things in their life don't matter. They've seen what they need to do. They've understood something. And they're going to put it into practice in their life. They're going to put their weight behind it. And it's really moving. And actually what happens to them is this kind of clarity almost contentment. Yeah, it's contentment. They know what they're going to do and they're going to do it. Even if it's difficult, even if it's embarrassing, even if it means standing up in front of a load of people and, you know, waving about a bit of incense. That's what they're going to do and it means something to them. So I've ad-libbed there. So when you get this understanding, you also get this kind of lucidity, this emotional backup to put it into practice, and a desire to arrange your life around your understanding. So Hui Neng's first response is, okay, so he heard this Diamond Sutra. He knew it was right. He knew it in the depth of his being. He understood it. And his first response was not, I mean, I would have been going, hey, guess what? It's amazing. I mean, you're just about to guess what happened to me. I just heard it. I just heard this. No, he didn't do all that kind of sort of naughty stuff. What he did, actually, the first thing that he said is, what is the name of that sutra? And what monastery do you come from? Because it was a monk reciting it. What monastery do you come from and who's your teacher? And it's interesting that, because what he did after that is he just put it into practice. He went to that monastery and got the same teacher. So there was none of this kind of jumping around and going, hey, I had the most amazing experience just then. He just said, right, where's your monastery and who's your teacher? And what's the name of that sutra so that I can hear it again? And he put it into practice. You know, it must have been quite a feat, actually, because he didn't have any money. He was selling firewood at the time. But he managed to get enough to persuade someone to give him enough money to be able to go. It's quite a long way to this monastery to find this teacher and become a monk. He actually really put it into practice in life. It changed his whole life. From that moment on, he went in a completely different direction. So the third thing was longing faith. The aspect of faith is longing faith. And this is described as a longing for those things that are real, have value and are possible. It's a longing. You've seen something that's true about the world. And you've got the kind of lucidity to know what to do about it. And then there's a longing. There's also a longing for what is possible. And it's a bit like sometimes this is kind of, it used to be a bit of a catchphrase in the FWBR. I don't know where it's gone, but I think we should reinstitute it at the Sheffield Buddhist Centre. And it was the infinity in you resonating with the infinity in the universe. And I love that. I just love it, you know. Because I think it's an actual experience that one has. You can get a glimpse of something and you get a glimpse of what's possible in the universe. You get a glimpse of what's possible with others. You see your own spiritual potential. And, you know, it doesn't have to be at the Buddhist Centre. It can be in a sunset, it could be in the Peak District, it can just be watching someone change. And it's like an experience of beauty that you just know. You just know, oh, there's a possibility. There's a possibility for something higher. And I'm going to get there. It's there's something within you that knows itself, that knows what it's truly capable of. And there's something in you that knows that it's part of the universe and sees the universe all around you and wants to be united with that. It knows that you're never separate from the universe. It knows that you're never separate from other beings. And there's a longing, there's an absolute longing to be reunited with that. And there's a longing to be enlightened. There's a longing to fulfill your spiritual potential. And, you know, you can get it in crazy things. You can get it in watching the movies. You can get it in all sorts of things. It's a kind of beauty. It's a bit like the world opens, and there just shines in this light of beauty. So, what have I said? Yeah, I've said it's a bit like an intuition. It's an intuition of who you really are. And who you really are is much greater than anything that you can imagine. And that until you're united with that potential, you'll always just feel this longing, you know. You've always got an intuition that actually there's something other. There's an experience that's other than this one at the moment. And then it's a possibility. It's a very real possibility for you to live out that experience. So Huineng has quite a big emphasis about this. He's got quite a big emphasis about seeing the nature of reality through understanding your own mind. And it's interesting because later on in the chapter, someone's actually trying to attack him, but being a good Buddhist, he manages to turn him round for attacking him into actually giving him a teaching. And person who's attacking him asks for an esoteric teaching. And Huineng answers, well, what I can tell you is not esoteric. If you turn your light inwardly, you will find what is esoteric within you. And I like to think of that as that longing, as responding to that longing, of turning the light inwardly. What he means by that is turning your attention, turning your awareness and your mind inwardly. You'll see it. It's a bit like you know it. It's a bit like it's just one of those things, you know, just in the corner of your eye. You know it all already, but you've just got to open yourself up to it. And that's what he says again and again. He says, well, you've all got the Buddha nature. It's just a question of looking that little bit deeper, of really looking and finding it within the nature of your own mind, of turning that light inwardly, of longing, of seeing that actually, you do have a spiritual potential, that there is a mystery within you, turning your attention to that mystery and unravelling it day by day. And revealing your own Buddha nature, that we're all capable of being Buddhas. And that goes for men, women, goes for people with wealth, people without wealth. It goes for whatever class, it goes for whatever caste, it goes for whatever social group you're in, whatever your hair colour is, whatever age you are, whatever, you know, weight or anything like that. Every single human being has the Buddha nature within them, and it's a question of really looking and really discovering that, of really reaching out to that longing for your own Buddha nature and living it out in your life. So that's kind of the three aspects of faith. And Huineng, well, he had this enormous faith response. He heard the Diamond Sutra, a bit like... last week on hearing the White Lotus Sutra, and he really lived it out in his life. He really took that as important and lived it out in his life. So he went off to this monastery and he saw the fifth patriarch, who basically said to him, why would I give you the teachings? You're a barbarian from the south. You're illiterate. I'm not going to give you the teachings, which was jolly nice of him. And so what did Huineng reply to that? He wasn't put off. He didn't just cry, which I probably would have. He said, although there are northern men and southern men, north and south makes no difference to their Buddha nature. A barbarian is different from your holiness physically, but there is no difference in our Buddha nature. So basically he's saying what I've just said. Actually, we've all got the capability, we've all got the potential to be a Buddha. It doesn't matter if I'm a barbarian from the south. Maybe, I don't know what this thing about him looking different. I don't know, they must be darker or something. Anyway. So he said this to the fifth patriarch. And the fifth patriarch looked at him and he thought, actually, this lad's quite bright. And he's from the south. And he's illiterate, and people aren't going to help him. They're not going to be a friend to this man. So he sent him off to split firewood and pound rice. There was no kind of recognition of good answer. He just said, right, no, you go to the stables. And he sought him out later and said, look, I sent you to the stables. I can see that you've got realization. But if you show that in the company of other monks, they're going to be jealous. So it's quite interesting. So Hui Neng didn't complain. Off he went and split firewood and pounded rice for 8 months. And then something happened. The fifth patriarch was looking for someone to take over the patriarchy. And he was looking for someone with realization. So he put a kind of competition to the monks. He said, give me a stanza, and whoever has the stanza that shows they've got complete realization, they will become the next patriarch. And basically all the monks freaked out and opted out and said, well, I haven't got full realization, but our teacher must have. So the only person to dare take up this challenge was one of the teachers at the monastery called Shen Huxiu. It's all right, Su Jin's not here, so that's fine. And so this teacher, Shen, let's call him, wrote a stanza up on a wall. He snuck up there at midnight and wrote this stanza anonymously on the wall because he was a bit embarrassed. And anyway, he wanted to do it anonymously at first, and then if it was any good, that would be all right. And then he'd tell the patriarch who he was. And, well, the fifth patriarch, he knew he wasn't enlightened. He knew Shen Sui wasn't enlightened. But he told them to venerate this stanza all the same. He told them to learn it off by heart, to recite it every day, and to offer, to venerate it and offer incense to it. So he saw it as quite important, and I'll read it to you. Sure. He says, our body is the Bodhi tree, and our mind a mirror bright. Carefully we wipe them hour by hour, and let no dust alight. So what he's saying, basically, is he's saying, well, you know, we've all got this Buddha nature, and it's a question of revealing its spotlessness. It's a question of carrying on with your spiritual practice and manifesting more and more your own inner purity, your own Buddha nature, of revealing that Buddha nature, of not letting any dust alight. It's a bit like our own Buddha nature is obscured at the moment by... you know, all the madness that goes on in our mind, greed, hatred, delusion, all that stuff obscures who we really are. And spiritual life is about uncovering that gradually, about wiping the dust off the mirror. So I think this is particularly about ethics, actually. It's about ethical practice and meditation. And it's really important because I think that in the story of Hui Neng, Shen gets a bit of a rough deal, actually. He gets a bit laughed up, a bit like, well... he wasn't enlightened, so his stanza wasn't any good. But actually, well, the fifth patriarch made the whole monastery learn it and recite it every day. And he also said unequivocally, if you put this teaching into practice, you will free yourself from misery. If you put this teaching into practice, you won't suffer. And that's no small thing, actually. It's a bit like if someone handed you a potion and said, if you drink this, you'll never suffer ever again, you'd go, well, that's brilliant, isn't it? And you'd drink it at once. And in a way, he was saying, this stanza is the same thing. If you really put it into practice, if you really practice ethics, practice meditation, and reveal your own Buddha nature, you'll never suffer again. You know, and it's talking about effort, the effort that you put in your spiritual life. And it's vital. That kind of effort is vital. It's vital in the spiritual life. I've just been on holiday to Thailand, and I have to say, I think I've found the most depressing place in the world, which was, to me anyway, which is a place called Bai. It's pronounced Bai, spelt Pai. Because basically it's like a mecca for travellers. But not just any old travellers, it's the kind of young and bronzed ones. So you go there and it's a bit like there's all these young men and women with really great tans, just sort of swanning about and sitting in hippie cafes and eating and drinking and sort of talking to each other. And it's soul destroying. And I actually found it like it wasn't even nice. They didn't even look happy. They actually looked a bit miserable and a bit hard. And it's because their whole life was actually just about, they were all long-term travellers, and their whole life was just about pleasure. I mean, that's what it is, isn't it, if you're doing that kind of long-term travelling. It was just about, like, when can I go to the next party? When can I get my next suntan? And I just found that just terrible. It just ate me up inside. And in that moment, I thought, oh, well, it's just so important that you need to be in the right conditions, actually, in your life, to keep having a faith response, to keep cultivating faith, to be in conditions where faith arises, and not in these conditions where it's all about yourself. You know, because in a way, if it's all about yourself, you're not going to be happy. The dust is going to alight on that mirror more and more, and it's going to obscure your Buddha nature more and more and more. And okay, well, sometimes the spiritual life is a bit difficult. Sometimes it's a bit boring. Sometimes it's in Sheffield. Sometimes it's in a caravan in Wales, and it rains for 2 weeks. But actually, what you're doing there will make you happy, because what you're doing there is, in a funny, subtle way, is you're revealing your Buddha nature, and there is nothing more wonderful and beautiful than that. What it made me think as well, yeah, that you do have to cultivate the conditions for faith to arise. It's a bit like Vedanya said quite a lot, and you might have heard this on your beginner's course, if you went on Vedanya's beginner's course, but... And it really struck me when Vedanya said this. He said, well, you've got to act out your generous impulses. And the more you act out your generous impulses, the more generous you become as a person. And it's the same with faith. The more you act out your faith responses to something, the more faith you will experience as an individual. So, okay, so you go and you're in the Peak District and it's really beautiful, and the infinity in the Peak District resonates with the infinity with you. And what are you going to do about it? Because I would ask you to do something about it. So if you want to go and light a bit of incense, or do a bit of chanting, really quietly like that, you can do it under your breath. It's really important to do that. It's really, really important to act out those faith responses. And but what will be even better than the little surreptitious Namu Tassa under your breath, or, you know, a bit of M&M's for the Davies or something like that. Instead of all that, what you could do that would be much more meaningful, though I think it is quite a good idea anyway, is to actually, whenever you get that faith response, to put it into effect into your life. Because it's really easy to let those moments go. It's really easy, you have a faith response to something and you're a bit embarrassed and you think, and you just let it go. But actually they're meaningful. Every faith response that we have is a bit like Hui Neng listening to the Diamond Sutra, and you need to live it out. Whatever it is, you need to live it out. You need to live out that understanding, that conviction, that lucidity, and especially that longing. You've got to put it into effect in your life every time. And it was interesting, actually, because me and my dad, we went to Japan and we saw this really beautiful Buddhist figure. It was quite out of the way, in its own temple, just on the side of a nunnery. And there was no one else there. And we saw this beautiful Buddha image. And you cannot help but see a really beautiful Buddha image that communicates such confidence, such contentment, such love, and energy and uplift and all those things, without having some sort of faith response, whether you're a Buddhist or not. So, of course, I was a Buddhist, so I had a faith response and I prostrated because no one else was there except for my dad. My dad looked really embarrassed.
He stood there like this.
Does that. That's where I've got it. If you see me pull my nose, it's from my dad. But it was like, you could see it, he couldn't contain it either. So what was interesting, I thought, I wonder what he's going to do about this. So he bought a book about the figure, which is fair enough, except for the book was in Japanese, and Dad can't read a word of Japanese. And I said to Dad, why did you buy that book? You can't read it. He's going, well, I just felt I had to do something. And in a way, well, that's what's going on. I think it's, in a way, I'm glad my dad bought that book. I hope, I don't know what he's done with it now, but Because it's showing that you have to mark that. You have to live it out in some ways. And okay, it's better to then look at a Buddha figure and decide to go for refuge to the Buddha and live out a Buddhist life. But in a way, you need to mark those faith responses. And you need to put yourself in conditions where those faith responses arise all the time. You know, we need to cultivate that more and more in our lives. So, yeah. So, completely lost where I am. So yeah, so Shen Suiyu does this stanza, and it's about creating the conditions for revealing our own Buddha nature. And part of that is creating the conditions for faith to arise. But there's something else, and this is what Hui Neng realised. He says, well, there's preparation, you know, there is preparation. But actually, once the preparation is over and you get the realization or the experience itself, something else happens. And this is what it says. It's a bit of a weird sort of stanza. I'll read it to you and I'll say a little bit about what I think about it. He says, okay, I'll read the first one first. So the first one is, our body is the Bodhi tree and our mind a mirror bright. Carefully we wipe them hour by hour and let no dust alight. And Hui Neng's response to this was, he says, there is no Bodhi tree, nor stand of a mirror bright. Since all is shunyata, where can the dust alight? So there is no Bodhi tree, nor stand of a mirror bright. Since all is shunyata, or openness, where can the dust alight? What does that mean? Well, I've kind of pondered this. I mean, it's one of those things that actually you'd need like a week's study retreat on or something. And I know Sangharakshita has done a seminar on this. So if you wanted to research it more, you could look at that seminar. But in a way, what I think he's pointing to is an experience. And it's an experience of actually realizing your Buddha nature. And when you realize who you are and who you've been all this time, there's no question of trying to purify yourself. You are it already, and you've always been it. You've never been separated from the universe. You've never been at loggerheads with everything that is. You've always been at one with everything. And it's experienced a bit like this. You know how ethics is a bit like, if you act like an enlightened being, you will be enlightened. But what happens when you get enlightened? Well, what happens when you get enlightened is you don't need to act like an enlightened being. You are an enlightened being. And you'll not act like that anyway. So it doesn't matter. You don't need to think in terms of ethics or structures or guiding principles or all those things that we teach you on the beginner's course. Because you're it. That's just how you act. You just act ethically. And you have this profound realization of, I was never separated from who I was in the first place. It's like enlightenment's not about, you know, picking yourself up and going somewhere, you know, some sort of cuckoo la la land where everyone looks like the Buddha. You know, actually, it's about realizing where you are already. And once you realize it, it's like you get, sometimes they talk about in these stories that they just laugh. It's like, oh yeah, I'm here already. I don't need to move anywhere. That it's all within you already. It's just that I needed to be sufficiently open to that. And I needed to work on myself enough so that I could be open to that. So I kind of like those two stanzas side by side. I think they work together. Because they're how you work on yourself, but what happens when you do work on yourself? What happens when you do have the realization? So basically what happened was, Hui Neng got someone to write this stanza up on the board next to the other teachers. And the fifth patriarch saw it and thought, well, this guy, he's got it. So what did he do? He wiped it off the wall. And he told Hui Neng to meet him at midnight. And at midnight they had a session where he communicated some of the teachings of Buddhism to Hui Neng, and he gave him the robe and the bowl of the sixth of the patriarchies. So Hui Neng became the sixth patriarch. And then he disappeared in the middle of the night. Because the fifth patriarch knew that the monks just would not take kindly to having some you know, upstart from some barbarian land who was illiterate, who, I mean, I should imagine he didn't meditate, because he didn't even know where the meditation hall was. He didn't meditate, he didn't know where the hall was, he was illiterate, he was a barbarian. He wasn't even a monk, he wasn't fully ordained as a monk. He was basically just treated as a servant, or even a slave, to the other monks. So he knew that the other monks were going to see this guy and go, well, I'm not accepting him. Look at me, I've been ordained for 30 years. How can he be the sixth patriarch? So he packed him off in the middle of the night. And I think this is really interesting as well, because I think it shows something that I've been reflecting on quite recently about mistaking the spiritual life for its outward forms. So what we tend to think is, well, I must be a really good Buddhist because either I'm ordained, or I'm a Mitra, or I meditate twice a day, or I've been on loads of retreats, or I come to the Buddhist centre 4 times a week or something. And I'm not saying that those things don't mean anything, because they really do. But at the same time, you can't hang the spiritual life on anything like that. It's not so obvious. You can't hang it on the outward external manifestations. You can only judge your spiritual life by your own mind and by how much you've become kinder and by how much you've become more aware. Those are the only things that matter. You can't hang it up on, you know, how many meditations a day you do, or whether you've got a white bit of ribbon round your neck, or whatever. It's actually how much you've transformed your own mind. And in a way, I think this can be really quite painful for people. It's quite painful for me. It's a bit like when my mum rings up. I'm just the most boring person in the whole world, because I can't pin my life on the external things. So what I find myself saying to her is, I want to say to her, all my list of achievements, my Buddhist achievements. Do you know what I mean? And since my salary is like, you know, just the national minimum wage probably, and I work here, and, you know, what can I hang it on? What can I hang it on? I can say, well, I chaired a meeting of the, you know, the teachers of the Sheffield Buddhist Centre. I mean, how boring is that? I only did that because no one else wanted to do it. What can I say? I'm on the Sheffield Buddhist Centre Council. I mean, who cares? It's like the most non-entity thing in the world. You know, I can't say to her, well, I did a talk on a Tuesday night about Hui Neng. She doesn't know who Hui Neng is. And but I find myself saying all these things to her, and it's a bit like it's because I want to be known as something. I want to have my status. I want to have my spiritual achievements put up there. You know, Vajratara meditated for 50 minutes this morning. That means she's dead good or something. But you can't do it. And like, also the Western Buddhist order is so sad. We're like the saddest order. We've got no kind of exoticism. We haven't got any film stars involved. We're all really poor, and it's not like, I mean, we're like the king of the dweebs, you know. We're not even monks or nuns. We don't even have the robes. We don't have the big viharas. We're just like the saddos of the Buddhist world. Oh yeah, I've got my kesa, which has an orange stain on it. Actually, I tried to show my mum my kesa, and she was singularly unimpressed, I have to say. So there's no trappings. That's what I love about this order. I want to be in an order that's the king of the dweebs. The most unfashionable Buddhist order in the whole universe. Yeah, so you can't hang it on all those kind of things. They're rubbish, they don't mean a thing. What you can hang it on is the transformation of your own consciousness. And that's what it's about. It's about living out that faith response, about becoming more and more true to that faith response, about living out that longing for who you really are and putting it into effect more and more in your life. And that can't be measured. Can't be measured by me, can't be measured by Hui Neng, and it can't be measured by my mother. And it's interesting because, you know, this is the spiritual life. And Hui Neng, he became the sixth patriarch. Big deal. You know, he was really like the head of the whole Zen school. He disappeared for 15 years. He lived with hunters and was a vegetarian. I mean, imagine what life that must have been. They thought he was a complete weirdo. He was a vegetarian living with a load of hunters in the mountains somewhere in China. And they didn't even respect him. There was no status. There was no, gifts, there were no disciples prostrating themselves, there was no royal patronage, there was no money in it. God knows how he survived at all. He didn't have any kind of income, he didn't have any status, he did not have any recognition. You know, he had this profound insight, and no one was standing at his door, knocking on his door, going, please teach me. He was a nothing. He was a nobody. He was a vegetarian amongst hunters. And in a way, what I like to think, well, what sustained Wee Neng through all that time? What could have done it? I mean, God, it must have been really hard. And I think, well, what sustained him was his faith response. And not a faith response in some kind of like, well, the Buddha's going to get me out of here soon. But a faith response in terms of this. He knew what was right. He knew reality. He was prepared to live by his knowledge in every atom of his being. He was prepared to live his whole life through that understanding. And he absolutely knew where he was. He knew the direct experience of what the Dharma was teaching for him, what the Dharma is pointing at. So he'd fulfilled his longing. And there is nothing else he needed. He didn't need status. He didn't need recognition. He didn't need all the trappings that come with the spiritual life. He had enough. He had those three aspects of faith. And that's what kept him going. And it was only after 15 years where he thought, now the time has come, I need to teach. And he went back down the mountainside and found a temple and monastery, and instantly they recognised, oh, you must be the sixth patriarch who's disappeared for 15 years. And that's when his long career of teaching began. So, anytime you feel a bit boring and lacking in status and like you're belonging to the biggest dweeby, poorest, unfashionable Buddhist order in the whole entire universe, just remember Hui Neng. It didn't matter for him. It doesn't matter for you.